Hello, Bill.
Hello, Matt. Is spring sprung?
Spring has sprung, and the Washington Nationals, your Washington Nationals, Bill, 2-0, undefeated and in first place, of course.
What's up with Strasburg?
Steven Strasburg is the ace pitcher for the Nationals. He had Tommy John surgery a couple years ago. Last year, the Nationals benched him right before they went into the playoffs in order to preserve his arm. It was very controversial. But he started opening day, pitched 7 scoreless innings. So he appears to be back where he left off.
So perhaps the naysayers perhaps should be offering some mea culpas. Perhaps they made the right decision, keeping his arm healthy, keeping the franchise alive.
Well, and I was one of the naysayers. Let's be up front. Let's be transparent about this, Bill. I was arguing they should not, you can't, there's no guarantees in life or in baseball. And if you make it to the show, you may never make it back. That Strasburg should pitch because he could spend the rest of his career and not make it back. But if the Nationals, I hope they prove me wrong. And please prove me wrong. And they very well met.
As I'm sure you're also aware, Matt, American baseball opening day happens to coincide with Aussie rules football opening day.
I'm keenly aware of
it. And my North Melbourne Kangaroos, I came up short in their opening match against the Collingwood Magpies. But we're still hopeful. You know, they were on the bubble last year. They just barely made the playoffs. And opening day is not always predictive of how the rest of the season is going to go.
This is true. for those fans who closely follow the show, I'm actually my team by birth is the Baltimore Orioles, and because they play in a different league than the Nationals, I think permitted to root for both teams until interleague play comes along. And the Orioles are 1-1, so it's not all joy here in Mudville.
But, I mean, do the prognosticators see a chance of a Baltimore-Washington Beltway series?
Well, they play each other in interleague play, I think every year almost, since interleague play came in, which I think happened about a decade ago. So since the Nationals have been around and they play the Orioles a lot, it used to be that they would have never played. In the old days, they would have never played unless they went to the World Series. In the days before interleague play, the Orioles dropped a really tough game last night. Here's the problem with the Orioles: they made it to the playoffs last year, but they won like 29 games by one run last year. And so the question is it an anomaly? Like, that sounds more like luck than talent.
Yeah, are you lucky but good? Are you just come out on the the dice rolled in your favor? Do you actually have some sort of institutional grit that allows you to pull off the tough games?
Every close game they won, basically. Whereas the Nationals, I think, are seen as legitimately, a powerhouse to reckon with for a decade. So things may be broken in Washington, but we've got one good thing going for us. And it brings people together. That's the thing in the Washington Redskins, especially in the old days when they used to win Super Bowls and they actually played in Washington, D.C., it can be that uniting force that brings people together.
So to digress, I achieved a big accomplishment for myself last night. I finished the Teddy Roosevelt trilogy by Edmund Morris, although I cheated by not reading the first installment. I read the presidential book, Theodore Rex, and the post-presidency Colonel Roosevelt, which is a fascinating book. His post-presidency is even more riveting than the presidency himself in many ways. And Morris's writing is just exceptional. You know, he really...
I've tried to listen on tape. Maybe that's my problem. I tried to listen to one of those books, and it's too heavy for me.
I think that would be a tough book to listen to.
Maybe I should have. Let me ask you, though, Bill, before I want to get into the substance, but when you've got a job, a couple kids, a wife, What is your routine for reading? Do you, when do you read? How do you logistically work it in?
To be completely candid, it is before bed and in the bathroom. Those are the only times. Okay.
I'm
where
I'm
any hope.
A visual here that I will not be able to unthink.
You asked.
Okay.
DMZ is all, you know, there's no rules with DMZ.
We do not pull any punches here. So, okay. I mean, I was going to try to replicate this, what's working for you. Okay.
But I've been trying to catch up on my presidential history. I've been delinquent in my life, and I've had my mind open to it since I did the research for that old New York Times piece that I did where right. I was, I actually was teasing out this theory about liberals and corporations, and I thought I needed to learn the backstory about the New Deal, expecting to learn why things were different today than back then. Because I assumed that FDR had, like, you know, strangled the corporations with his bare hands. And why would Obama have to take a different path to win health care reform, Wall Street reform? Why did he have to compromise more than FDR did or LBJ did? And in reading my FDR and LBJ backstory, I found out that it's not different, that FDR and LBJ had to do all these same sorts of compromises. And so that was very revelatory to me, and it made me realize that there is this canon out there of history books that dig a lot deeper than what you see in real time watching a presidency when you're alive, and the kind of, you know, thumbnail summations of history you get in high school and what gets repeated, you know, in the course of daily life, because a good historian gets access to so much more private correspondence, internal memos, is able to take the various oral anecdotes that have passed around and match them up to see are they all in sync or are people telling different stories and which story actually has the most merit to it.
I'm interested in the process sort of side of this, Bill, because as I get older and try to find a way to remain relevant and to keep getting paid to basically, you know, go to the ballpark every day, you know, you can't keep up with the BuzzFeed kids. You're not going to be as fast as them. You can't obsess on, day-to-day breaking news as much. You can't always be the first to tweet, especially when you have kids. But one of the things you can do maybe that they can't is gain wisdom and knowledge. And if you're tweeting all the time and following the news all every moment, you're not going to have the time to read an Edmund Morris tome. And so it strikes me, Bill, that this is an important thing for a mature commentator, writer, pundit to do. I mean, we should have all been doing this all along, but it's also serving, I think, a pretty important function because the historians and the writers who write this stuff aren't the best equipped to transmit their ideas to the masses or to put it in context of today. So you sort of play this role where you are aware of current events and politics, and you can take these lessons from history and apply them. And this is what I do a lot of, actually, with philosophy and history and whatnot, making it in essays and in columns, making it relevant today, and introducing an audience who might not go read a huge book to some, you know, authors, historians, philosophers, whatever, theologians, whatever, and making it relevant and also bite-sized. And so I think this is a really cool thing that I know you've been doing for a while now, and I think it's a great transition as your career develops.
Well, thank you. I'm doing in part to find ways to take history and make it relevant, but of course you got to slog through 1,000 pages first before you know you're going to find an anecdote that's going to have the relevance.
You can't sort of reverse engineer it. You just have to it's like prospecting. I mean, you go out there every day and dig, and eventually there'll be that aha kind of epiphany moment. But it could go, you could go a week without that or more.
Right. Right. And this is sort of the catch-22. I always had a real bad attitude about history because I didn't grasp what the relevance would be. I didn't read a lot of history in college. I didn't spend a lot of time of it in early adulthood or my early career. And now that I'm getting the relevance and finding ways to apply it, I'm running out of time. You know, it's like
I feel the exact same way. Like in school, I think a lot of my politics has to do with the fact that that I'm an introvert, believe it or not. And part of being an introvert is I want to be left alone. I don't want to be a part of your team. I don't want to be forced to do anything. I don't want you to force. And I'm sort of this contrarian. I don't like people telling me what to do. I have a hard time working for people unless they're the right certain type of people that I really respect. And I didn't like teachers telling me what to do. Now I read. I have read more and learned more since leaving school than I ever did in school. And that's the opposite of a lot of people who cease learning the minute they get their diploma. But you're right. That now it's the thing is like, damn it, I wish I'd been doing this. You know, I think it was Ronald Reagan who said, I only wonder how far I might have gone if I just applied myself.
Well, if I had chosen to be an American history major in college, I mean, I was a politics major in college. So I'm not totally, I wasn't totally off the track I ended up on, but it wasn't history. And if you know, I essentially had 4 free years to read all these books.
but you didn't have a reason. You lacked the reason.
Well, I lacked the reason. I lacked understanding why. Because I would crack a book like that, and a lot of these books are not well written, and are hard to get through. And if you don't have a professional incentive to find the nugget,
And a lot of the teachers, I'm sure, weren't the most inspiring in telling you why this is important and making it real to you either. Let's be honest.
That may be true, but I was not an eager enough student where I'm going to blame the teachers on that. I was clearly trying to avoid as much work as possible back then.
I don't like wasting time. And so, you know, I don't like working with other people. I don't like being told what to do, and I don't like wasting time. Well, those are great if you do – in my business, those are actually – In some cases, attributes. But in school, they're really bad things. And I think that's part of it is that there is a type of person that excels and succeeds in the school environment. And that is not necessarily a predictor of future success.
No.
At least not if you want to do what I do. Which is come to the ballpark every day.
I want to shift this to something I want to ask you about conservatism, because after finishing the Morris book, and I was sort of hesitant to read the Morris Roosevelt books because I felt he got really his reputation got scuffed up when he wrote his Reagan book Dutch. That was the first I had become aware of him. He for those who don't know, he actually was Reagan's official biographer. He was in the White House for the duration of his presidency, and he spent several years after the presidency was over before publishing the book. I think it came out in 98, and it was controversial because he chose to use a unprecedented first person narrative, a first person yet fictional narrator who was present not just at the White House, but throughout Reagan's life, which Edmund Morris obviously was not, and even in the process created a few fictional anecdotes. That at least that's my understanding. I haven't read the book yet. And, I mean, Morris was transparent about this. It wasn't a secret. He was explaining this as a narrative device to explain the Reagan persona and Reagan himself.
It just seems sad because when you've been granted this incredible access, as he was, to need to introduce a risky device, which could understandably turn off a lot of readers, seems a bad idea. I mean, we can agree on that.
Well, I mean, that sort of was my attitude when I first heard about it, and I was not inclined to pick it up because of that. Having read the Roosevelt books, which he does not do in first person, but there still is a tone that is a you are there kind of tone. I mean, right. He is very rich in his descriptions.
Okay, and but let me just so it'll be a thing like I'll just be the narrator here. It'll be like it was a cold wintry morning as Theodore Roosevelt got on the train. He stirred his coffee as the train shook and nearly spilled. Now, there's no way that he could know that. Now, maybe if he's a great historian, he looked back and he saw that it was 28 degrees that day in Buffalo, New York. He doesn't know that he stirred his coffee. I mean, maybe someone put it in a memoir. At what point does this artistic license become misrepresentation?
Well, yeah, there's no way I could go back through all of Edmund Morris's notes to know to what degree is he sourcing
it's possible that someone, in a diary noted that Roosevelt spilt coffee or something. I mean, it's possible, but it just it's so vivid. It's so much like birds were chirping as theater. It's like there's no way that he would know all of this stuff.
But Morris didn't get any kind of flack for the Roosevelt books. He is totally lauded for the Roosevelt books. I mean, he won a Pulitzer for one of them. And all the other ones and the subsequent ones were all gloriously reviewed. I mean, this is now seen as one of the quintessential, Roosevelt biographies.
Pulitzer Prize winning.
Right. And so I just went out to a really good used bookstore here in Greenfield, Massachusetts, Federal Street Books. They had a 50% sale this week. I got Dutch for, $4. And so I'm now willing to give it a second chance, knowing this is just Morris's style. And maybe there's actually a lot of interesting insight in Dutch that is getting overlooked because people got hung up about his device that he's using. I can't judge it yet. I haven't read it, but I'm willing to give it a second look. So I have that on my shelf, and I have the Lou Cannon. Lou Cannon did a trilogy on Reagan, and I only have the third installment about his presidential years before Once of a Lifetime, which came out only, I think, 3 years after the presidency was done. So Cannon was chronicling Reagan, kind of in real time. And I think he had a lot of good sources inside the White House, because I've got a few pages through the book, and I can see that he had a lot of personal conversations with Reagan aides in real time that he's recounting. And my understanding is that the Cannon book is seen as sort of the best Reagan book that's out there, that's the most definitive, because the Morris one is not seen that way.
I think Barack Obama read that one over vacation.
Is that right?
The Lou Cannon book.
So it made me curious, Matt. In conservative circles, where Reagan is, the idol amongst idols, what is the basis of the average professional conservative's Reagan understanding? I mean, do they all read the Lou Cannon book? Have they all read Dutch? Are there other books that they read? I mean, I guess the corollary question is, how deep really is the understanding of Reagan? Have they actually gone through all the good and the bad of his presidential managerial approach and internalized all that? Or is there just more of a superficial Reagan won the Cold War, and he fired the air traffic control union workers, and that's that.
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say that just as you had not extensively read about FDR.
Right. And I'd say most liberals haven't.
I would suspect that it's about the same on the right, that that most conservatives, even those professional, have not extensively read about Reagan. Now, you could make an argument that it's much that the superficial image is much more important than the actual record, because most people, because the superficial image reaches a much wider audience. I think you're right. I think the Lou Cannon book is probably the definitive book. I think the Edmund Morris obviously had the best access, and I think it's tainted because of that literary device. I would say if I had to guess, the most widely read Reagan books are probably the most accessible. So, like, Peggy Noonan had a really good Reagan book called When Character Was King that I like a lot. I think Dinesh D'Souza had a Reagan book that was pretty widely spread. But there is a lot of ignorance amongst the political class. It reminds me of, like, you know how some of the young baseball players or NBA players or whatever have no reverence for the old players. They don't know, you know, who Stan Musial was or something. Some of them don't, even though they're professionals. I remember several years ago, I knew this guy who worked on both Bush campaigns, both W. Bush campaigns. And then he was invited here at some business meeting to meet Mike Deaver at Edelman Public Relations, Public Affairs. And he met Mike Deaver and had no idea who he was. And this isn't some jamoke. This is a guy who was, you know, a young guy, but a guy who had worked on two presidential campaigns.
This is like David Axelrod, right?
He would have been like the David Axelrod at this time. I mean, Reagan really had three really close confidants, Ed Meese, Mike Deaver, and Lynn Nofziger, and then James Baker became the chief of staff. So, I mean, this is like, he was part of the inner circle. Speaking of which, Mike Deaver had a book called A Different Drummer that I've read. That's a pretty good short history of Reagan. There's a book called Nofziger about Lynn Nofziger, Reagan's aide, that obviously talks about it. Bad Boy, The Life and Politics of Lee Atwater, obviously talks about Reagan. And a friend of mine named James Strock wrote a very nice little book called Reagan on Leadership, where he goes through some of the things Reagan did and does kind of what I said you and I can do with our essays and our columns, is to he kind of marries history with leadership lessons. And he also did Theodore Roosevelt on leadership as well, though. I guess I would venture to say that a lot of people who kind of worship at the altar of Reagan aren't intimately knowledgeable of him. I certainly have more to learn, but I think it's not uncommon. And as you mentioned, you were surprised when you found some things about FDR. So I suspect it's bipartisan.
Oh, yeah, I actually don't think it's a unique thing to the right. I mean, I think there's all sorts of things about FDR and LBJ that the left is ignorant about. And I think even worse, you know, there's the little bit of knowledge problem where people quote certain FDR, LBJ things and don't understand the context of them. You know, for example, everyone loves to say FDR said I wear the corporations are unanimous, their hatred for me, and I welcome their hatred. Everyone loves that quote, but they don't realize they said that after all the New Deal stuff got passed. It wasn't how we got the New Deal stuff got passed, and in fact, it was a precursor to FDR's hubris prevented from building on the New Deal in a second term.
I think analogous to that would be Reagan's 11th commandment: "Thou shalt not speak ill of a fellow Republican." Which, of course, is interesting coming from a guy who, you know, ran against Richard Nixon as a favorite son in 1968, ran against a sitting Republican president, Gerald Ford, in 1976. So, you know, he may not have spoken ill, but he was certainly willing to involve himself in internecine battles. But, again, you can always use that line. Anytime somebody... you want to hit somebody for saying something about another fellow Republican, you can accuse them of breaking Reagan's 11th
right. Amendment. You play the Reagan card, that shuts you up.
It can, yeah. The other thing, Bill, too, is I wrote a piece about a year ago about how Reagan raised taxes 11 times. And that might, you know, to some conservatives, that might shock a lot of them. I point out that, in fact, the overall trajectory of Reagan is lower taxes, and it's unfair for liberals to, you know, say, well, Reagan raised taxes 11 times if the implication is he was a tax hiker. On the other hand, it's important for conservatives to actually know he actually did raise some taxes.
There's a zigzag quality to Reagan's tax policy over the course of the of the 8 years, which again, yeah. even if you're, even if on the conservative side, you're saying, well, look, Reagan still was a net tax lowerer, and we should praise that. It does raise the question, you know, can you still be a good conservative and raise taxes in certain circumstances? Do you have to be yeah. so absolutist about it all the time? And then, and some of that would, it would be antithetical to Reaganism. That would suggest that's not the case.
Marginal tax rates fell dramatically during his time. A lot of the taxes that people say he raised, you know, I think when people say he raised taxes, the assumption is income taxes, but a lot of times it wasn't income taxes. These are all like, you know, the devil's in the details things. But we've talked about amnesty and then 1986. And I mean, they're so, you know, history is so much richer than the bullet points oftentimes.
Well, let me accelerate us to modern times.
Where, nice segue.
What do you think is the bigger story in conservative circles this week? Is it the Mark Sanford runoff victory in South Carolina, or is it the Ben Carson 2016 boomlet?
I would have to say Ben Carson. Mark Sanford, I don't think has gotten that as much play, especially at the beginning of the week. Ben Carson is, who knows if it'll sustain, but he's now sort of occupies that space that others, including Sarah Palin, have had, where if you mention his name, if you put it on a blog post, you'll get hits. He's sort of the it conservative right now.
Now you've been trying to put a bit of a damper on the boomlet, it seems. And I've seen a couple others do the same. It feels like the same social dynamic within conservative movement circles to get really excited about the guy with no political resume at all.
Right.
It feels very Herman Cain. And I to take the race equation completely out of it. To get all that excited about somebody here, Herman Cain has a pithy line and he's a real businessman, and obviously going toe-to-toe with Obama, I think there was an element of we can neutralize Obama's race as a positive factor if we have our own black guy to go up against him. 2016 is maybe less of an issue because you don't really know who that Democratic nominee is going to be. But obviously the Herman Cain experiment was a colossal disaster, and once the spotlight was really on him, all these things that you didn't know about him started to surface, and his ability to handle tough questions, you know, began to be seriously questioned. Why would conservatives want to, you know, get that excited this early? Why wouldn't you want to at least, you know, why would you want to see him go through his pace a little more? And two, why wouldn't he be encouraged to aim a little lower than president when all you've been, I mean, he's obviously a very celebrated neurosurgeon, but, right. you know, running a government is different than surgery.
Yeah, but I mean, the problem is the president stuff was sort of foisted upon him.
Was it really? I mean, he seems to be very cheekily encouraging it.
I think he is, but I don't think we're doing him any favors when we play into that. I mean, this is a very interesting story, and there's so many components. Bill, I do think there is a racial component. You mentioned Herman Cain. We could also mention Alan West. I do think, and this is controversial, but Touré went on this rant on MSNBC, and most of what he said I disagree with. I think he tried to imply that conservatives are racist or whatever. I don't think that's true. But I do think he was onto something when I think the conservatives are so obsessed with proving that they're not racist that sometimes they will elevate someone prematurely. And I think it's a disservice to that person. And so I think that's part of it. I think that there tends to be an inverse relationship between being an experienced politician and being exciting. Mm-hmm. Now, every once in a while, the stars align and you get a Reagan or a Rubio who can be both. But by and large, really experienced and competent politicians are boring. And the people who are interesting and say controversial things are inexperienced. And so I think that there's a hunger amongst conservatives for someone who just sort of speaks truth to power and just says it how it is. I think that this reminds me a little bit also of Sarah Palin, in the sense that it's not fair to most of us. If you're a politician, most politicians sort of work their way up. You know, they get elected to city council or mayor or Congress from some district nobody cares about, and you sort of learn, you know, you make your mistakes in the minor leagues, you know, not at the pro, not in Yankee Stadium. If you're a pundit like myself, you start blogging somewhere and you grow and you mature and you make mistakes. And by the time you're like on prime time, Fox News or whatnot, you've sort of honed your message and you've worked out the bugs. Sarah Palin was airdropped in the middle of a presidential race. And, you know, that's a difficult thing. And I think that, you know, that Dr. Ben Carson here is similarly, you know, within a month or so, all of a sudden he's now like in this spot. And I think there's, you know, you need to nurture. Look back to Steven Strasburg, right? The Nationals nurtured him. They kind of took it slow, and they saw him as this rising star of the future. Well, the conservative movement is saying, no, you're going to pitch a full game every day of the week. I think that's counterproductive sometimes.
Now, the other aspect of Carson that I find strange is, I mean, the first splash that he made was that he spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast with Obama sitting next to him, because it's an event that the president often speaks at, and he lashed into Obamacare, you know, at what's typically not all that political an event. It's supposed to be a very bipartisan event. And the video of that was very viral. I know Rush Limbaugh, you know, talked it up. And what strikes me as odd about it is, I would think that the conservatives would just get off of Obamacare. Like, that you would think that eventually you get to a point where, like, you know what, we lost that one. It's the law. It's going to be implemented. Let's find another issue. It seems like you just can't let Obamacare go. And therefore, you're going to take the dramatic leap to, okay, we're going to make this so central to our 2016 strategy, we're going to have a non-political neurosurgeon as a potential nominee to make this front and center. That strikes me as an odd strategy.
Well, I think a couple things there, Bill. First, I think you're right. Oftentimes, conservatives, and everybody probably, but conservatives are more interested in winning the argument than winning the election. I think that Cal Thomas, a conservative columnist, was critical of that prayer breakfast speech and thought it was too political, and he was attacked by a lot of conservatives. And I think maybe it had an effect, because the last column he wrote was very praising of Dr. Ben Carson. So working the refs does work, at least on some people. And then the last point I would make, though, is I think that this is an example of really wasting of a missed opportunity. I mean, having an African-American conservative who is a leading neurosurgeon in the country could be very powerful for conservatives. And having someone of that stature, that cachet, who is eloquently making a case for conservatism, he could be a conduit where bringing more, you know, intellectuals and professionals in the academic world and the medical profession into the movement. He could be reaching people. He'd be a great example of someone who could really reach independents and moderates. And the conservative movement could really use someone like him to show that we are acceptable for intellectuals and professionals and serious-minded people. And look, even this very highly regarded doctor is conservative. But I think that the rhetoric that he's used is more like he's auditioning to be a talk radio host.
Which may well be the case. This may not be 2016 related at all, for all we know.
I mean, I don't know if that's his agenda or not, but if it is, it's a missed opportunity, and he's undervaluing himself, because he could have been, and I don't want to say could have been, because I don't know that he's thrown it away, but I think he's in danger of becoming caricatured now. But I feel like he could have really been a very valuable spokesman for the conservative cause, and with his experience and his reputation, and I feel like he's just kind of throwing that away to become like a conservative pundit. And God knows there are enough of us out there. There aren't, you know what there aren't enough of? Highly regarded African American neurosurgeons who are conservative. That's what we need. Why not be that guy? Why do you want to be? You know? So it's just very frustrating.
Well, the other 2016 news, if we can call anything 2016 related thing news, you know, more Hillary chatter, and it feels like the tone of the Hillary chatter is starting to shift from inevitability to the armchair quarterbacking style of Hillary coverage that we were used to seeing in the 2008 campaign. In particular, you have a Salon piece sort of holding up a line for her. Is she going to pass the 2008 test? Is she going to make some of the same mistakes she did in hiring her campaign staff, like going back to Mark Penn, who famously had a very inept campaign strategy, totally missed the whole caucus strategy that Obama has as far as racking up delegates, and hamstrung Hillary's messaging to not be in sync with what the Democratic base was looking for, all that kind of stuff. And this is where you have to wonder, do early polls matter? Does notions of inevitability matter, or do they just set you up for a fall? Because Clinton's in general, Bill or Hillary, attracts such microscopic coverage where every utterance, every gesture, I mean, and this goes in sync with Hillary's video she cut in support of gay marriage, which was a policy shift for her.
A dramatic policy shift. Did you see the video I think Dave Weigel or somebody put up?
It's Sullivan. It was unbelievable. It's Sullivan.
Or she talks about the sanctity of marriage. And
right.
Believe me, I know how. I've been married for all these years, you know. It was like really, I mean, you might have heard, it might have been something Pat Robertson would have, a speech Pat Robertson would have delivered. But I guess you changed your mind on that.
I look at that and say, this is pretty politics 101. The country was a different place in 2004. Democrats were nervous about being pilloried as antithetical to the fabric of American society. This is when there were all these anti-gay marriage ballot initiatives. In the states, they really much wanted to beat George Bush. They didn't want this to become a distraction of an issue, and so they echoed a lot of language from conservatives on the subject.
So you're saying she was lying then when she talked about that she was a strong believer in, you know, traditional marriage between one man and one woman, and that it's vital to preserve the sanctity of marriage. She was doing that just for political purposes. She didn't really believe it back then.
It's possible. I mean, I think at minimum it was for political purposes. Whether it means she's a liar, I think is a tougher charge. I don't want to get inside her head, but look.
I mean, I hate to. I don't like to throw harsh terms around. Maybe she had an evolution, but it seems kind of convenient to me.
But that sort of evolution is highly usual in all of politics on all sides. This happens all the time. So,
I agree with you on that. But number one, she's running for president, so I think she's held to a little bit of a higher standard. And then the other thing too is, and I wish I had the tape here. I didn't prepare as I should have. But find this. I think Dave Weigel put it up. It's been around. Maybe I think Andrew Sullivan posted it too. I mean, she didn't just say, I'm for traditional. I mean, this was like really impassioned. I've never spoken this glowingly about marriage.
How many conservatives were upset at George H.W. Bush for running as a pro-choice candidate in 1980 and running as a diehard pro-life candidate in 1988? No one cared.
Well,
it was a total flip flop. But there was no
on taxes. They cared though, and maybe that's
That's true. But that was an action taken in office, not a rhetorical shift on an issue that
I grant you that I'll concede that point. But Bill, you know, I was always skeptical of Mitt Romney's pro life conversion, and a lot of other people were too. Oh. I mean, you know, at the age of 50. to change your mind about when, you know, about a fundamental issue like that. Oh, and just conveniently right before you run for president, that was my knock against Romney, so I think it's probably fair to have a knock against Hillary in that regard.
Oh, I mean, it's fair. I'm not saying it's an unfair thing to make. I do think in the case of Andrew Sullivan, he is being sort of disproportionate in the outrage about it. but these are fair things to talk about. I would talk about it in broader perspective and not just think it's some sort of a uniquely odd thing that just Hillary did. I think this is pretty standard fare. But it does speak to the knock on Hillary in general, that she is a calculating politician without court conviction. That has sort of dogged her throughout, and I think that's what dragged her down in the match against
Iraq.
Obama.
The vote for Iraq.
Well, exactly. That was the biggest one. And maybe less remembered is the way she danced around the immigration issue in the primaries, where she couldn't give a clear answer about driver's licenses and immigration. So, you know, these things have always, and so when she sort of stumbled on the answer in one of the debates, it raised this issue, oh my goodness, is Hillary going to be, you know, just mincemeat in a general election campaign because she's going to get caught up in all these evolutions.
Right. I will say this, Bill, I don't know who's going to win, but I do think that a lot of the success Democrats have had has to do with the fact that Barack Obama is an exceptional and unique politician. And I don't know that Hillary Clinton will, that anybody else for that matter, will be able to be as adept. Doesn't mean they won't win, but I think that, you know, Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, Barack Obama, there are certain people who are a little bit better. No, he can't shoot baskets that well, but as we learned. But otherwise, he is LeBron in many ways.
Well, now Hillary is going to have a built-in disadvantage relative to Obama, in that Obama was, you know, was a much fresher face with a shorter record of public statements and votes. Not that it wasn't non-existent, but a lot of it was at the state legislature. He had a short time in the U.S. Senate. You know, Hillary has all of her U.S. Senate time, all of her first lady time, and all of her, you know, 2008 presidential time of statements and votes to pour through. I mean, I think on some level, I suspect that Hillary is sort of newly liberated, that she has a much deeper reservoir of support now than she's ever had, a much greater sense of feel like she's paid her dues, she's uniquely qualified. You really can't say that she's not up to the job. Her demeanor on the campaign trail might be very, very different than it's ever been before. But even if that's the case, all these past things are still going to get thrown at her, and she'll get charged with all this hypocrisy based on stuff like Sullivan just did with that video.
Right.
And so it at least makes you have to pause. But I think on the way to being the nominee, the coverage you're starting to see again is going to make people pause, saying, wait a second, are we going to go through a lot of, you know, Clinton fatigue again and make us nervous from a Democratic standpoint? Is that going to make us nervous about how easy a general election is going to be? Or are people going to really internalize, look, she's slogged through all this muck before, and we have a confidence she's prepared for it, and we'll deal with it. I don't know what the Democratic diaspora is going to feel about it, but I think the coverage tone is going to change.
What happens if Hillary's denied again? I mean, do they have to put her on the ticket at least?
Well, I doubt she'd take – I mean, she's going to be 68, 69 in 2016. Why would she be VEEP? Yeah, why would she wait eight years?
It just seems like if Democrats don't nominate her, if someone else beats her, that it's going to almost be like they're denying her what she's earned.
Well, and I think particularly amongst those who feel that an unfair glass ceiling has been put on her, I mean, that could be very divisive in the Democratic Party if they feel like she was unfairly denied the post again.
Right.
Or even if you don't feel that that's again, but that's unfair now, you know, that would be a very bitter pill to swallow, particularly if it's, you know, denied in preference to a white man with much less experience. Except for Joe Biden, no one else is going to run that's going to match your experience. And that's sort of the classic glass ceiling irritant. You know, why are you denying the person with clearly the most experience? There's no real policy reason why Democratic Party shouldn't embrace her. She has no real taboo position on something that make you angry. It has to be a sexist reason that you're putting on that's making you disqualify her. That's going to be the argument. I think if you're
a Republican, you have to say, like, who knows if we're going to win or not, but it's going to be a lot more fun. I mean, if Republicans, if they nominate, Chris Christie or Marco Rubio or Bobby Jindal, it's going to be much more interesting than Mitt Romney or John McCain. There's no doubt about that. For journalism,
I don't think John McCain was boring. Mitt Romney was boring, but John McCain was interesting.
Yeah, but John McCain circa 2000 would have been more interesting than
McCain 2008. I agree with that too.
So,
outside of 2016, as far as today's elections are concerned, there is this Mark Sanford victory, the Mark Sanford comeback. Talk about redemption stories. He very brazenly had his former mistress, now fiance, at the victory party.
She showed up to surprise him. That's
right.
That's the story.
I'm assuming that Sanford was not unhappy about it, or he's certainly not suggesting any indication they thought that it was bad form for her to show up. He is his fiance. You know, he can't throw her in a closet. It's like we don't know about the whole backstory. Is there a sense that Republicans might throw away what should be a solid Republican seat by nominating him? Is there a blasé attitude about that? Because, look, it's just a special election. Maybe she wins it for a few months, but we'll get it back in 2014, so who cares? And is there any concern that he's just making it – it's another obstacle for the party to get past the 2012 failings, have to answer more questions about social conservatism and hypocrisy? He got hit on CNN saying, how can you be anti-gay marriage? How can you deny someone else their ability to love who they want to love when you broke your marriage vow to love who you wanted to love?
Well, my personal problem with Sanford is not about sex. It's about the fact that when you're a governor of a state and you go missing for 3 or 4 days and your staff, I guess, ostensibly either doesn't know where you are or lies, that is a dereliction of duty. And that is a betrayal of trust. And doesn't mean that I can't forgive him personally, but he worked for the public. And if I had an employee who went missing, I would fire them. And I would not promote them or hire them back. But apparently the Republicans of South Carolina had made a different decision. And they have decided to rehire him. So to me, it wasn't about sex. It was about dereliction of duty. It is just one of 435 House seats, so it's probably not that surprising that it's not getting a tremendous amount of attention. I think it's a blasé attitude right now. I think that there's a sense that it really doesn't matter that much if he wins or loses, and which is sad because when he was in the House, he was a really, really reliable fiscal conservative, very a good voting record. And he was even mentioned as someone who could run for president in 2008. In 2012, had this not happened. And so, I guess Fitzgerald was wrong. There are second chances in the American life.
But I don't get that the conservative movement is fully embraced, even talking up again as a national figure. They're just sort of, politely ignoring his presence.
Well, it's also interesting. I mean, he got a Fox News gig, sort of in the interregnum. So they paid him like $100,000+. He's also running against Stephen Colbert's sister. That's how I identify her, despite what anybody tells me. She is Stephen Colbert's sister. Now, I pointed this out. The funny thing is, Sanford's victory party was at a place called Sticky Fingers. And I don't think, Charleston, I believe, is part of the district. I don't think it was at that location. But if you ever go to the Sticky Fingers in Charleston, which I've been to many times, there's a portrait, the famous Stephen Colbert portrait, hangs at Sticky Fingers. So I thought that was kind of ironic that they had the victory party at a Sticky Fingers. But it's a weird, weird story. And, I mean, on one hand, you've got so many storylines. There's a storyline of, Republicans talking about being the party of family values, and yet they don't seem to have they don't want gays to get married, but, Sanford's fine. On the other hand, I think there is a story, the sort of story about siblings in politics and the way that, it's not enough to just have Kim Kardashian. You also have to know about Kourtney and Khloe. And the way that siblings kind of ride on the shirt tail of their more famous siblings. I mean, I assume that Stephen Colbert's sister, as I call her, has some things to recommend her, but I'm not sure she'd have been the Democratic nominee had she not been Stephen Colbert's sister.
No, I'm not on the ground in the district, so I can't say how she is being perceived by the locals there. But it seems to me that, she is not – I don't think she's being treated as a joke candidacy or as a celebrity candidacy. My understanding from her campaign materials is that she's really stressing, her business background. But what Colbert gives her is access to money, that he can throw fundraisers and she can attract money nationally that she would not be able to attract otherwise, and also help to clear the field and not have to slog through, a messy primary. So she has that built-in advantage, but I don't think she can carry that through a general. It's not, she's not running in Hollywood, she's running in South Carolina. She's not running in an area that is probably a big fan of the Colbert Report, quite frankly. So it's not even like, it's the kind of celebrity attachment that you really want to hug on too tightly. I think they're sort of walking a line with it. But at the end of the day, Sanford probably it's probably in his interest to demean her as Stephen Colbert's sister and not her own person to try to deflect from his own baggage. And I suspect, she's going to have to run a race that's going to highlight her own positions and her own biography and not let Stephen over-dominate the race.
Yeah, that is a danger. There is the danger that that there could be a backlash against it. And maybe Sanford can play kind of a populist card. My brother isn't some big, New York City or Hollywood or whatever, comedian. I don't know. I mean, Sanford's first wife was kind of like, wasn't she like Kennedy or something? I mean, so it might
be. Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I think she might have been somehow. She's related to some aristocratic family and I think worked for Goldman Sachs or something. I don't know. So it might be hard for him to play that populist card the way that the way he otherwise might, but we'll see.
We'll see. Should we end it there, Mr. Lewis?
Let's end it because I've run out of things I know, and now I'm purely speculating and perhaps making things up. So yeah, it's a good time to call it quits.
Always good to talk to you. You're
likewise.
In the DMZ.
All right. Good show.
And we'll catch you next week.
You got it on the DMZ.